Fastamai, hello and welcome to this edition of Agenda. I'm Ewan Gorn. Most people know something about the University of Liverpool's Marine Biological Station in Port Erin, but on this episode we take a deep dive into how the first closed area of seabed on the island, and possibly Europe, was set up. We speak to the man who is instrumental in making that happen, including gradually winning over the island's fishermen, and one of the divers who surveyed the bottom of the bay as part of the project. The Port Erin Closed Area Project was set up in 1989 to show what would happen if the seabed was protected from fishing. The project, thought to be the first of its kind in Europe, was a success, showing how, if left undredged, sea life, and more specifically scallops, would flourish. The Marine Biological Centre closed down in 2006, but the area remains closed to fishing. It's recognised worldwide for its success, with a far greater number of scallops found in Port Erin than in other regions around the island, and it's led to the development of other closed areas. I spoke to the man who made this Port Erin project happen, Andy Brand.
I came here in 1966, appointed a lecturer at the Port Erin Marine Lab, and my job there was to work on local fisheries, scallops, queen scallops, and at that time there was a big herring fishery as well. So I was involved in fisheries research with scallops and queenies initially. And then in 1972, I had a visitor from Tasmania who was on a world tour looking at scallops. And he'd just spent 3 weeks in Japan, and he came to Europe, and he came to the island, he went to Scotland, he went all around Ireland, Scotland, France, and here, and told us all this exciting stuff that the Japanese were doing with farming scallops, because they'd had a fishery like ours, which had sort of collapsed. So they started farming them, and they were really successful. So we all got excited about that, and 4 or 5 different projects started in Europe, including one in the Isle of Man, which I set up.
Tell us about how you went about setting it up.
Well, we had all this information about how the Japanese were doing it, so we went to do it just the same, using onion bag spat collectors. Scallops produce larvae in the water column. Then they settle normally on the seabed, but if you put netting bags in the water column, they settle on those. And so we were able to collect lots of little scallops and then keep them in cages in mid-water initially. And so that was really how it started. Mm. And that, as I say, was in 1972. The closed area didn't close until 89. It took me 10 years to persuade the Manx government and the local fishing industry that we needed to close off quite a substantial area of their fishing grounds so that they wouldn't be able to get at.
What was the reaction like to that proposal then initially?
They didn't like it. It took a long time, but Lawrence Corlett, who was the CEO of DEFA at the time, he was very supportive. And eventually we got this close area, which was about a nautical mile square, of a ground that had been fished for many, many years. I wanted that area because it was close to the lab and it was convenient for us, but it was also a well-established fishing ground. So it wasn't surprising, really, that it did take a long time. So we set up this closed area initially to do farming scallops, which we did over a number of years, a lot of projects. And then along the line, it became obvious that there were other features about closing an area that were of interest, because scallop dredging doesn't have a very good reputation around the world for its impact on the seabed. and people were starting to get concerned about impacts on the seabed. But we'd had this closed area, which was the first in Europe since 89. And so with our divers, and we were able to follow what was happening on the seabed. And so we were very early in on the study of fishing impacts. That was at a time when fishing impacts were just becoming to the forefront of people's minds. So I was able to get quite a lot of money from different sources to do projects on fishing impacts.
So did the project naturally evolve as you understood what you could understand yes. from the area?
Yes, it did, yeah. Yeah, with scallops on the seabed, if they're fished, then fishing reduces their life expectancy. So over a period of time, you get lots and lots of young scallops and all the big ones disappear. If you stop fishing them, then they live longer, they get bigger. The bigger scallops have bigger gonads, they produce more eggs and sperm. So you're getting greater reproductive potential. So this is what happened. And if you look at the scallops that can be taken out of a ground that's not fish, or that the boats that were going in there illegally were taking out, they were getting, at one point, something like 15, 20 times the catch that, in terms of weight, that they were getting outside the closed area.
So did you inadvertently, I suppose, although it was illegal, create quite an attractive area for fishermen?
We did, yes, yeah. And in fact, scallops have a closed season every year, which nowadays I think starts in November or something. And at the start of the season, every year, the boats would be fishing up and down the boundary of the closed area because you're getting this overspill phenomena. The scallops swim short distances, so there's loads of scallops in the area, but some of them swim out. Some of them also settle outside. So the area around the closed area is also a good place for scallops. And so you could see that every year. And the fishermen could see it too. And gradually they came on board, and they then realised that the people that were not being strictly honest or legal were actually taking money out of their own pockets by doing that, and gradually they all came on board. And in fact, of course, since then, there's been a whole series of closed areas, there's about 10 of them now, and that wouldn't have happened without the fishermen's agreement. In fact, the closed area off Ramsey was a project that they initiated.
Can you tell us about some of the people who worked with you on that project? Have you kept in touch with many of those people over the years? Do you know what they've gone on to do? Any notable figures from that time?
Well, there's one notable figure. The first person that worked on the settlement of scallops here in the early 70s was Dr. Jeremy Paul, who's now an internationally known wildlife artist. So he started out as an undergraduate here, and then he worked on scallops. And then he went off and worked in Scotland for a while, and eventually became a wildlife artist.
And of course, there was lots of younger people who were starting out on maybe an academic career who took part in the project as well. Yeah. There was quite a buzz about the place.
Yes, there was. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Gosh, I can't remember all the names now. Yeah. Cause I supervised, I think, 40 PhD students, mostly on scallops, but not all. And then they went off around the world doing different things.
And there was, you mentioned from Australia there was a real international presence, wasn't there?
Yes, very much so, yes, yeah. I mean, the whole lab was very international. You know, at one time we had virtually 100 people working down there, of which probably half of them were out from overseas, yeah.
So you mentioned how the fishermen did get on board and see the benefits, but I just wanted to ask you, was there any ongoing opposition and people who refused to accept that this was a good thing?
Well, they didn't all jump at the same time, and so they went slowly. And so inevitably, there was one person who was the last. But I'm not going to mention any names. He knows who he is. And so does everybody in the fishing industry.
Well, we won't name names then. So, and you did touch on this as well just previously, but do you know of any examples of the project having a direct influence worldwide or prompting similar work in other countries?
Oh, yes. The way science works, it sort of develops. You know. One of the things that I was involved in very early in 76 was we established a scallop working group called the Scallop Workshop, which is actually a conference that we had every 2 years. And I think the first one was in 74, maybe, and I organised one here in 76. And now that has gone on, and they've just held the 22nd of those meetings. And that brings together the research scientists and people, some people from industry, all around the world in different venues. It started out as a European thing, but gradually grew, and now is worldwide. That's been beneficial. And it means that people studying scallop all over the world are in very good contact, because you meet up every 2 years, have a good time, and talk about scallops for a week.
Well, I don't think we'll stretch this to a week, but were there any challenges in preserving the boundaries of the closed area?
I mean, yes, that was another feature. Mm. When we first started, my feeling was that all the boats were using Decca navigators at the time, and they knew exactly where they were. But when we had some problems with incursions, they said, oh, how can we know where we are if you don't mark the area? So the Manx government came up with 15,000, maybe £20,000 for six buoys to go around the area. And these automatically lit buoys, and they were a nightmare. Because the boats would be fishing along the line of the buoys, and they'd tangle with the chains and break the chains, and a several thousand pound buoy would end up on a beach in Ireland, and we had to pick these things up and put them back again. This went on and on for a long time. That was the bane of my life, keeping the buoys on the station.
What differences do you see, not just in terms of scallop populations, but do you see on the seabed in a closed area compared to somewhere which is open to fishing?
You see very different, much more diverse populations, because there are a lot of things that are very sensitive to disturbance. They disappear completely. And the things that are able to withstand disturbance, they carry on. So over time, you get a different sort of biodiversity on the bottom.
And do you have any memorable experiences in the water when you went out? I know, speaking to Lewis Feel, he was talking actually about moving the buoys and how that was quite a fun, but arduous exercise. How about you? Do you have any particular memories of being out?
I was never a diver, so I just employed people to do that.
Did they not drag you along?
I used to go out on the boat, yes, yeah. And we would have to make decisions about how we were going to do it, and then often things would get tangled up. And
if you could go back, would you do anything differently? Would you approach anything differently?
No, I think we had to learn by experience. I mean, clearly, knowing what I know now, I would know what not to do. But at the time, they seemed sensible decisions. And in fact, as it's turned out, farming scallops around Britain or around Europe is not really economically worthwhile. The species has certain biological differences from the Japanese one. scallop farming works really well in Japan. It's worked well in some other places. I mean, there are a lot of different species, maybe 20 or 30 that have been farmed around the world, but only two or three of them have turned out to have the right sort of characteristics for mass cultivation.
Can you summarise what you think the contributions of the closed area have made to our understanding of fisheries management? Which is very topical at the moment.
It is, yes, yeah. I mean, the fact that we were able to close one area and convince the fishermen that was beneficial for them, then led on to these other closed areas. And I mean, I think you should talk to people like Peter Duncan, DEFA, and he's been involved in a number of the more recent closed areas. And so they're now very much involved in the local plans for managing inshore areas.
You're listening to Agenda on Manx Radio. Lewis Veal worked on a UK government-funded project to look at the impact of scallop dredging on the seabed. A PhD student and a diving technician, he started working at the closed area in Port Erin in 1994. I spoke to him about his involvement in the project.
Well, it was the ongoing monitoring of the closed area. My primary role, as I said, was a dive technician. So I was working closely with Mike Bates, who ran the dive centre there for many years until its closure. Also alongside me there was Ben Hextall and Dave Pennington, who were PhD students and dive technicians themselves. And between us we worked on the monitoring of the progress of the recovery of the seabed in the closed area. So that varied from going out in the boat and taking samples by chucking a big metal grab over the side, to doing experimental dredging in very small areas, to doing diving, which was obviously the best bit. And we would do that with some very high-tech equipment. It was basically a 4-metre-long bit of plastic drain pipe with a reel of string rope mounted in the middle. And we would go down a shot line to a weight at the bottom on the seabed, attach the reel to this shot, and then basically go out in a straight line for 50 metres, crawling along or floating just above the seabed, noting down all the animals that we saw on the way on a high-tech bit of plastic with a pencil. And we sort of repeated that process many times over the summer, and obviously repeated that every summer for subsequent years.
Was there any remarkable dives you had that you remember?
It's probably a bad thing to say, but on my very first one, I got so enthusiastic about the fact that there was scallops sat there on the seabed, you know, which obviously are tasty to eat, so I sort of stuck a couple in my dry suit pocket. And then when I got back on the boat, I got such a telling off that, I chucked them back over the side, because that's the whole point of a closed area. You're not supposed to be taking scallops out of it. That was a bit unfortunate.
What differences do you see on the seabed in the closed area compared to nearby areas that are not closed?
It's very similar to a ploughed field and a wildflower meadow, basically. You know, when you look at the seabed that's been dredged, the seabed is a uniform sand or pebble, whatever, you know, there's no variation in size really. It's all groomed into, you know, combed into one direction, into a shape. It's fairly barren, not much living there. You might occasionally see the odd scallop or whatever and fish swimming over it, but in the closed area it's a world apart really. You know, it's there's a lot more variety in the sizes of the stones and the pebbles and the cobbles and what have you. There's intact dead shells and things like that down there, all of which form a substrate for sessile animals to live on, you know, so that animals are attached to the seabed. So there's things like sea squirts and hydroids, bryozoans, etc. And all those things in themselves provide habitats for other things to attach to or live in or hide amongst. Primarily, you know, obviously an important thing is for scallop spat itself, you know, because scallop babies start life floating around in the plankton. And when they reach a certain size, they attach to something which is raised up off the seabed, and then they grow a bit for a year or so, some period of time, and then they drop off and become free-living seabed creatures. So it's important, obviously, for them to have something to attach to when they're coming out of the plankton. So the hydroids particularly are a good thing to attach to.
Does that have any benefits, the closed area have any benefits on the surrounding areas? Is there any sort of associated benefits that go out?
Yeah, well, I mean, probably primarily it's that, given something to settle on, scallops back can mature and get to a particular size within the closed area, and that, you know, scallops don't move much, but they can move. You know, we've all seen the sort of flapping scallop on the wildlife programs, so they can move out into the surrounding area. And obviously, if there's a density of spawning and spat settlement inside the closed area, that'll have an impact on the immediately surrounding area. I think it's fairly well established that closed areas are good at improving the fisheries in the surrounding areas.
Have there been any challenges in maintaining the boundaries to the closed area, or were there in your time?
I think, as I understand it, the delineation of the area based on the charts should be enough for anybody with, you know, with GPS or what position fixing equipment to know when they're inside or outside the closed area. But as we know, there's a set of buoys marking the outside of it. And when I first joined, part of my job was to help with the maintenance of those buoys. So we'd have to go out and change the light bulbs and the batteries and whatever. But the worst part was changing the chain, because the chain goes from the buoy down to a big block on the seabed. And where it rubs around on the seabed, it gets scoured away, rusts away. And so it needed changing every year or two. And they're blooming heavy, those things. And so our first attempt to do it, we went out on the Sula with the new chain, attached the one end of the chain to the underside of the buoy, chucked the other end off the side of the boat. And then when we got to the bottom, we, of course, realised that where it had landed on the bottom, it was nowhere near the block because of tide pulling it off at an angle. And so we ended up having to basically drag the end of the chain across the seabed at 40-odd metres, which was a ridiculous thing to be doing, really, to get it to the block and then shackle it in place and get it back up again. So after that, we sort of realised that we needed to loop the end of the new chain to the old chain so it would ride down the old chain and end up in the right place. But it was quite an eye-opener that first time we did that.
You were diving, but another way of assessing the seabed was using a camera, which you did use. And tell us about what you saw.
Yeah, we wanted to do a project over one of the summers where we placed a fixed camera on the seabed and just to monitor what happened or observe what happens when typical scallop dredge discards get chucked over the side. Obviously, when you do a scallop dredge, when you fish for scallops with a dredge, you get a lot of bycatch, which is damaged and broken up and what have you. What happens to all that dead material, dead or dying material? So we placed a camera out in the closed area on the end of a cable, which was a kilometre long, the end of which was in the marine lab, and it was attached to a time-lapse recording system. So the first problem we had was to get that cable from the marine lab out into the closed area, and that involved diving around where the sewage outlet now isn't there now, but was there at the time. And so we were wearing full face masks to protect ourselves, and it was like diving inside like a snow globe, you know, because of the sewage waste coming out. So that was pretty disgusting. But then we got the cable out far enough and mounted the camera on a frame, and then baited it, and then we could observe all the beasties coming in, all the scavengers coming in, which was primarily crabs, starfish and fish. But because we'd record it in time lapse, they were obviously moving cartoon fast, which was always quite entertaining to watch. But we learned quite a lot about what happens to the discards there. And obviously it's going to have a very positive effect on the population of starfish, for example, because they're benefiting from all this bycatch. And that then in itself will have a negative impact on the fishery, because starfish are a predator of juvenile scallops. So by fishing and causing damage, you're actually increasing the damage and the predation from the starfish as well. So it's another impact of a closed area is to eliminate that.
How do you feel about your involvement in the project, looking back? Were you proud of it?
Yeah. No, definitely proud to be involved in it, and involved with the marine lab as a whole. You know, that was a great facility to have on the island, and it was a real shame when the University of Liverpool closed it down. I think it brought influence and brought people to the island as well. You know, there's still a lot of people hanging around who came over as students and who are still here. And also on the project side of things, it's obviously nice to see publications that are now, which were in journals at the time, are now on the internet with our names on it. It's quite nice to know that lives on for posterity.
That's all from this programme. We'll be back with more from Agenda soon, and you can listen again to this edition online via the Manx Radio website or through Spotify. But for now, Gurumayu and goodbye.